From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, we listen back to Terry's interview with comedian, writer, and actor Buck Henry, who died Wednesday at the age of 89. He wrote the screenplay for The Graduate, one of the first films about the generation gap of the 60s. It also launched Dustin Hoffman's film career and generated the Simon and Garfunkel hit, Mrs. Robinson.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Buck also co-created with Mel Brooks the 60s spy sitcom Get Smart and was a frequent host of Saturday Night Live in its early years. We'll also listen back to Terry's interview with trumpeter and Schoolhouse Rock singer Jack Sheldon, who died last month at the age of 88. And John Powers reviews The Outsider, the new 10-part HBO series based on the Stephen King novel of the same name. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Buck Henry, the screenwriter and character actor, died of a heart attack Wednesday at age 89. In the 1960s, he emerged as one of the sharpest comic voices for a new generation. He co-created the TV series Get Smart with Mel Brooks, wrote the screenplay for The Graduate, and even had a small role in that film as a hotel desk clerk. And in the 70s, when Saturday Night Live premiered on NBC, he was one of the earliest guest hosts during that all-important first season.
Thank you all very much. Now, you're probably wondering, as I am wondering, why I have been chosen to host tonight's show. After all, it's quite true, I'm not a comic. I don't sing, I don't dance. Sure, I've acted in a few films, a few television shows, I've written a few, but those aren't ordinarily the prerequisites to fronting a big show like this one. I probably wasn't their first choice.
Saturday Night Live hit the 70s like a bombshell. And before that, in 1967, The Graduate landed with just as huge an impact. Directed by Mike Nichols, it told of an aimless college graduate, played by Dustin Hoffman, stumbling into an affair with an older woman and family friend, Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson, oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are, you got me into your house, you give me a drink, you... put on music, now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Terry Gross spoke with Buck Henry in 1997. Their conversation took place at the Film Forum in Manhattan as part of a celebration of the then 30th anniversary of The Graduate. They spoke after a screening of the film, which ended with Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, barging into the wedding of Mrs. Robinson's daughter, Elaine, whom he now loves. They run off together, making their getaway on a public bus, but after a few moments of triumph and exhilaration, they're both staring blankly into space.
Well, let's start with the end of the film. The end of the film, it's kind of like a few beats after the typical happy ending. You know, they run away together, boy and girl get each other, real triumph, and then the camera just lingers longer on them than it normally would, and you see their faces drop and this, like, uh-oh, what now expression come over. Did you know that that's the way it was going to end when you wrote the screenplay?
No. Well, let me lead you up to it. Nichols was always disturbed by the idea that in the book, Benjamin gets to the church in time to stop the wedding before the vows have been taken. And he always thought, it's too corny. It's like the cavalry coming in at the last moment. So we thought, well, let's let him get there after the ceremony is over and really wreak havoc. It isn't Christ's symbology when he's up there pounding on the glass. I mean, there's a guy in a church pounding on glass, so critics are inevitably going to make of it a Christ symbol, which it wasn't intended to be. Perhaps if he'd have pounded one-handed, things would have been different.
If there was blood coming out of the palms of his hands.
with a few scars. But that was not intended, and had we foreseen it, we might have done something differently, but probably not. And the cross, which I think was my idea, but I don't remember any longer. I just thought of it as, you know, a kind of vampire thing. Get back, you bloodsuckers. And And then naturally sticking it in the door seemed the next logical thing to do. So they're running away, and they get on a bus, and they ride, and Mike had a long roll left on the film, and I don't remember him. I think he just didn't tell Catherine and Dustin anything in particular except sit down there and take a ride, and we'll see what happens. And, of course, what happened was they had nothing to say, nowhere to look, and so the sort of sense of, good Lord, what's going to happen next, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for the actors to feel, became part of the character and now has become this sort of legend in some people's minds who haven't seen it in the last few minutes, that the scene lasts for 10 minutes and they're sitting there and it's the, as I read in someone's critique of it in the last few days, it's a whole, it looks forward to the end of the 70s and the doom of that generation, blah, 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 blah.
Well, in the film world, I mean, I think it's fair to say now that a lot of producers aren't comfortable with ambiguous endings. And a lot of test audiences at the focus groups before a movie is released, they don't like unhappy endings. And a lot of endings nowadays are changed so that viewers get what they want, which is a happy resolution. There was no such thing in 67, 68 when this was coming out, right? You didn't have to test market it.
No, actually, no, I don't think we did test market it. But also, well, there are two aspects of this that are interesting. One is that it tested, when it was first shown in theaters in previews, the audiences were receptive beyond any of our dreams. The other thing is that the opposite of that is when Mike showed it first to a kind of friends screening, it wasn't quite that respect. The audience wasn't quite that enthusiastic. I mean, they said, oh, it's terrific, it's funny, it's interesting to look at. The kid is weird, isn't he? It's a shame. He's so odd-looking, big nose. So it's always, you know, you can't second-guess from any particular group.
Any producer saying the ending's too ambiguous, you've got to
no, nobody ever said that. And also, it is a happy ending with a little slice of lemon in it. I mean, it is perfect. He's got his girl, and they've run away from the people that they're scared of, and they're going to have either a long or a short happy life for a while. Who knows?
When the film came out in late 1967, it really tapped into something. There weren't really many films at all that were addressing this generational split, that were addressing the alienation that college people felt when they went home back to their parents' houses and they knew they didn't fit there anymore, and they didn't want to be there anymore, and their parents' friends were kind of scary to them. So this tapped into that at a time when Hollywood was always like several beats behind what was really happening in the world, and TV was even more beats behind that. What do you remember of what people were saying about what The Graduate meant, you know, to our culture when it was released? And what rang true to you, and what did you think was really, like, absurd?
Gee, that's a lot of questions in one. You know, it's odd because we didn't think of it as defining a time or a place and went about making it assiduously avoiding the errata of contemporary politics. And the only vague mention is when the guy who has the rooming house says, "Are you an outside agitator?" Which was more about Berkeley than it was about the time. And actually a critic, when the movie was released, took us to task for saying nothing about Vietnam, which I thought was really stupid, because it's simply not what it's about. It does come from a sensibility of some years before the time it was made, although I think the sensibility is universal. The sense of alienation that people have between teenagedom and 20-something years old, when they feel most hostile, a lot of people do, most hostile to their environment, to their parents, to their schools, to all that stuff. And since we all came out of the same time and the same sensibility, that is, Charles Webb, who wrote the book, Mike Nichols, Larry Terman, and I all came, got out of school, got out of college in the 50s, we all related to the same sources of that displeasure or enemy or whatever you want to call it.
To me, one of the greatest paradoxes of the movie is that it's about, you know, a young man who comes home and he's just so lost in his parents' environment. And so what does he do? He has an affair with his parents' mother. You know, it's the first film that really addresses the culture, you know, the generation gap. And so he's sleeping with somebody of the other generation. It's really mm-hmm. paradoxical.
Always a good idea. To pass the time and to get to know new friends.
I remember when I saw it, when the film came out, one of the things I couldn't imagine any of the men I know, any of the men I knew, any of my friends, sleeping with my mother's friends or with any of the mothers that we knew. It was just unimaginable to me. I think most of us saw our mothers as not being sexual. And so this was like a different world to me.
Now, well, there are two very different things, sleeping,
yeah.
You know, sleeping with your mother's friends or someone sleeping with your mother. They're
right.
Loaded in very different ways.
Right. Now, I'm thinking your mother was a silent film star. She was a beauty.
An uncomfortable segue, but yeah. Yes.
But I'm thinking that you probably brought up in a world where women were very glamorous and very sexual.
There were many of my mother's friends I would happily have risked social approbation for.
So the sentiment in this movie rang true.
Oh, yeah.
Buck Henry speaking to Terry Gross in 1997. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with screenwriter and character actor Buck Henry, who died Wednesday at age 89. They spoke in 1997 at Manhattan's Film Forum, right after a screening of The Graduate. It was the film's 30th anniversary.
Now, when The Graduate came out, I think it was still very uncommon to have actual records used instead of just a score written for the movie. So the Simon and Garfunkel records tie-in was very novel, and it was very successful. Mrs. Robinson rose to number one on the charts, and it really certainly helped Simon and Garfunkel's career a lot. Whose idea was it to actually use records?
Mike had Paul's music in his head from the very beginning. I wasn't that familiar with it, but I listened to it a lot while working. He thought, well, Paul was going to write a whole new score, but Hello Darkness, is that what it's called?
Sounds of Silence.
Sounds of Silence. You'd think I'd know. Sounds of Silence, they put Mike and Sam Osteen, the editor, put Sounds of Silence onto the working track, and you know, there was never anything that could replace it. Finally, I think the only original song Paul wrote for it was Mrs. Robinson, which we all thought was cute and catchy, but hardly a world shaker. And you know, there we are. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what are they called? The Strawberries?
The Lemonheads.
Lemonhead. Yeah. Well, I was in sort of the right area. They did a really nice version of it.
You've said that when you were writing the screenplay, you saw the character of Benjamin as being a very kind of prototypically Southern California, blonde, surfboard kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not Dustin Hoffman.
Everybody.
It doesn't fit anything in that description.
We thought of all of them. Well, we used to call them the surfboards. And we thought of all of them as being big and blonde and Southern California. You know, I mean, there is a genetic thing that happens. I don't know how it happens, and I think science should investigate it, is that the darkest and most exotic Jews moved to Southern California, and in one or two generations, all the children are blonde and tall and blue-eyed. What what happens? What is it? Sand gets in the genes. And so we thought of, and Charles Webb was tall and blonde and very prep school looking. So we thought of them all as being the blonde family. Ideally a Ronald Reagan, Doris Day, mother and father, and a Robert Redford, Candy Bergen, kids. And, of course, that fell apart as soon as we came around to really looking at actors doing it.
So when you saw Dustin Hoffman on the screen test, what made you think that even though he didn't fit at all your image of what this character should be, that he was right?
Yeah, well, it was there. The soul was there. And also, he was. It's a great screen test. I think he did it with Catherine, and they're just terrific in it. It's really good, and you just see it. He just wiped everyone else out.
Did you see the character as being insecure and neurotic in the way that he is in the movie?
I don't remember anymore.
He supplanted what you had in your mind.
Yeah, they become the thing you thought you'd invented but didn't really know was there. It was so interesting. So then we rationalized it because we'd been talking about them as being surfboards for so long. We had to make up in our own minds what happened. So we said, okay, it's a genetic displacement. It's the other way around. He's a throwback to previous generations. And then around him were fit actors and actresses who really could do it. Not that there aren't blonde people who can do it. It just didn't have the same suption, as Faulkner would say, if he were here.
Now, how did Anne Bancroft get the part of Mrs. Robinson? She had not too long before The Graduate played the saintly and sacrificing Anne Sullivan in The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller, and this is a long distance from that.
Well, she was a famous and loved actress.
She's wonderful.
And nobody ever, there was no question that she could do it and really do it. She was advised by everyone except Mel not to do it. At least that's the story they
tell.
Were
they married then?
Yeah.
She and Mel Brooks?
Yeah.
I'm going to squeeze a little question into the couple of seconds we have remaining, which is, did you identify, aside from admiring some of your mother's friends, did you identify with the Benjamin Braddock character at all?
Totally.
You did?
Oh, yeah. And so did Mike and so did Larry. We all did. I think that's what drove them toward the book and me subsequently, too.
If you identified with Dustin Hoffman's character, that kind of adrift, I don't have a future, I don't know what my future is, what was the turning point for you? Where you found writing, you found theater and movies?
Well, I always knew I wanted to do it. It was just a question of people not letting me. So when I was younger, I got out of the Army and I spent years, like 7 or 8 years, sort of batting around. I'd go on tour with a show. I'd write things that nobody would buy. And I did all that stuff that actors do. And then finally I started working in television and it all became a clearer path. I was never, I'm very lucky. I've never been out of work since I started working. But the number of years before that were very edgy.
Buck Henry, thank you so much for coming. It's wonderful for you to be here.
Thank you, Terry.
Buck Henry speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. He died Wednesday at age 89. Coming up after a break, we remember Jack Sheldon, jazz trumpeter and schoolhouse rock singer, who died last month at age 88. And as we say goodbye to Buck Henry, let's revisit his famous scene from The Graduate. He plays a front desk hotel clerk, welcoming a young and very nervous Benjamin, played by Dustin Hoffman, who wants to get a room for an intimate encounter with his parents' friend, Mrs. Robinson. I'm David B. Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
Did you sign the register, please? Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
And where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I mean, I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have the toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
Our Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, committed to protecting cars and drivers, whether on the open road or having a driveway moment while listening to NPR. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to ensure that families and communities have opportunities to create a brighter future for America's youth. More information is available at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Jazz musician Jack Sheldon died last month at age 88. As a big band and recording soloist on trumpet, he was featured with Sinatra, Bennett, Goodman, Basie, and Gillespie. His bandmates have included Chet Baker, Art Pepper, and Zoot Sims. For listeners of a certain age, Jack Sheldon may be even more familiar for singing one of the bounciest and most memorable songs from Schoolhouse Rock.
I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee, but I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will, but today I am still just a bill.
A lot of patience and courage.
Well, I got this far. When I started, I wasn't even a bill. I was just an idea. Some folks back home decided they wanted a law passed, so they called their local congressman, and he said, "You're right, there ought to be a law." And he sat down and wrote me out.
In addition to bringing his hip way of singing to Schoolhouse Rock, Jack Sheldon has played on the soundtracks of nearly four dozen films, including The Pawnbroker, The Pink Panther, and White Men Can't Jump. And he recorded the very first rendition of The Shadow of Your Smile for the film The Sandpiper. For 18 years, Sheldon was resident comedian for the band on The Merv Griffin Show, then led his own big band in Southern California. He played on such TV themes as The Munsters and Peter Gunn. Terry Gross spoke with trumpeter Jack Sheldon in 1993 when he had just released an album of duets called On My Own, featuring Ross Tompkins on piano.
This love of mine goes on and on. Though life is empty since you have gone, you're always on my mind. Though out of sight, it's lonely through the day, but all the night I cry my heart out. It will surely break, since nothing matters, just let it break. I ask the sun and the moon, the stars that shine, what's to become of it, this love of mine.
Jack Sheldon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
I don't know why I had this image of you, but I always thought of you as somebody who relied a lot on humor in their singing and music. And there's something so emotionally naked about some of the songs on your new record that really surprised me. I really love the singing and the playing on it. Is the choice of material or the kind of singing that you're doing a relatively recent development with you? The kind
well,
of ballad
I've been trying.
That
I think I'm singing better now. I'm studying singing, and so I just can do it better. But I've been doing it all my life. It's it's more naked, I think. More, I like that, emotionally naked. That's good. Yeah, I guess I'm just developing into where I can do more personal, you know, stuff and better pitch and just things I've been working on. And studying it, too, helps.
Well, that's interesting. Tell me what you're getting from learning how to sing. I mean, taking formal lessons.
Well, just real simple stuff. But, you know, to have a lot of foundation, get a lot of air and use your diaphragm. And I notice now when I, if I'm having trouble with a note, it's really because I don't have the foundation there to, you know, get a lot of air in my stomach and my diaphragm and to open my mouth wide. You just learn real simple things that you'd think you'd do, but you don't really. And then practice the pitch and the articulation. It's just things like the trumpet with the, you know, hitting every note precisely in pitch. And it's good to take lessons and study like that, because then you have, you do what you do, and then somebody can criticize you and in a nice way. They're real nice to me, and they're real encouraging.
Was there another change that happened to you besides taking lessons? Did something happen emotionally that left you more open to this kind of material?
Well, I got sober 8 years ago, and I don't drink or take drugs or do anything like that, and I think that left me teachable. Before that, I thought I was really cool, and I knew everything. So, and I didn't want to take lessons. I thought I was better than the teachers, you know, and I really just didn't know what I was doing. And then when I got sober, I found out there was a lot of stuff that I didn't know, and that people didn't use me, not because they didn't like me or anything, because I couldn't produce what they wanted. Now I'm trying to get to be able to do anything any composer might want.
When you were playing in the 1950s, bop was the thing, and very few of the instrumentalists sang. Did you sing back then, and were you self-conscious about singing at all?
Yeah, I was always self-conscious about singing. I wanted to sing, but it's so personal, singing. And I started singing with Benny Goodman's band, and that was about 1958. and I wrote a song, and Benny let me sing. He was the first band leader that would ever let me sing. Stan Kenton wouldn't let me sing, though, because he always was afraid I would say something too off-color, which I probably would have.
Did you have a reputation for doing that?
Yes. I worked with Lenny Bruce, and I was trying to kind of emulate him at the time.
What kind of work did you do with Lenny Bruce? You were in the band playing at the club or something?
Yeah, in burlesque, I worked with Lenny Bruce. We worked with his wife, Honey, and Joe Maney, and Philly Joe Jones, and Kenny Drew, and Leroy Vinegar. We had quite a real good band there. And we played burlesque at a place called Duffy's in Los Angeles. And Lenny was the comic, and we did all kind of... he would write stuff, and we'd act out. We did The Man with the Golden Arm, and...
Oh, really? Like your own version of that?
Yeah, a burlesque version.
Well, that must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was funny, I think. I think it ended up where the guy flushed the dope down the toilet, and then Lenny said, there's only one thing to do, is smoke the toilet. It doesn't sound so funny now. You really had to be there, I guess.
That's Jack Sheldon speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. He died last month at age 88. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Warner Brothers Pictures presenting Just Mercy, based on the true story of a modern hero, starring Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx, and Brie Larson, now playing only in theaters. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1993 interview with jazz trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon. He died last month at age 88.
It's interesting to me, you know, you're taking lessons now in singing and trumpet, and I'm glad for the fact that you're not becoming overly obsessive in your performance on technique. I mean, you still, like, play trumpet solos in which there's kind of clear ringing notes, but also these, like, wonderful, like, smudged, arpeggiated kind of figures. You know what I mean? I'd hate for you to give that up just because you're learning good technique.
I'm going to have that smudge for life, I guess. My teacher says that. He says, I don't want to ruin your style or anything, but I don't think there's much chance of that. I would like to get as clean as I can, but the smudge is there, I think. It's in my bones.
Why don't I play another track from your latest album, On My Own? And I thought I'd play some of I Can't Get Started, because it kind of shows off everything, your trumpet playing, your singing, and it shows both, like, the emotionalism of your singing and also some of the humor in it, too.
Okay, thanks. I've flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted, still I can't get started with you. Around the golf course, I'm under par. And Benny Goodman made me a star. I had a house, a show place. Now she got that and I got no place. And I also can't get started with you. You're so supreme.
That's Jack Sheldon on trumpet and vocals from his new album, On My Own. There's a really interesting documentary about the trumpeter Chet Baker that you were featured in. You were one of the people interviewed about Baker. And I remember you saying that, and I should mention that, like you, Chet Baker played trumpet and sang. And you were very funny about him. You talked a little bit about how frustrating it was that he never, you were always in a room rehearsing, you're practicing, and he never had a practice or anything. He always just had the sound, and he always looked
he
so
did.
Great.
I hear Harry James never had to practice, but I have to practice all the time. Doc Severinsen practices all the time. But, you know, I was singing back there with Chetty when we were little kids, come to think of it. We were both singing, and we'd sing together, and we grew up together, and... we would sing, we had a little quartet, we'd go around and play in little bars for $2 or anything we'd get. We just would drive up. The bass player, Hirsch Hamel, had a Pierce Arrow, and we'd have the bass in there. And, you know, it was a 12-cylinder old car with a place for a chauffeur and everything.
How old were you then?
Oh, I was about 14, 15. I was about 15. No, 16, I guess.
And how did you...
Because I was in Florida when I was 14. I was 16, and Chetty was about, I think, about 18 or 19.
How did you meet?
I think at a place called the Showtime, which was on Sepulveda and Ventura Boulevard, and it was a jam session on Monday nights, and all the guys that were on the road would come in there. I got to play with Art Blakey in there, and Stan Kenton, and a bunch of people. Maynard Ferguson would come in there, and Chetty and I would always just sit in. To me, it was, you know, the glittering night of stars of jazz, and I was just thrilled to be there.
Now, how did you get to the West Coast from Florida, where you grew up?
Well, my aunt came out here first from Florida, and she was a swimming teacher. Crystal Scarborough was her name, and she taught babies how to swim. And then we moved out here, and my mother started teaching swimming, and I taught swimming, too. And we got a pool on Hollywood Boulevard. My mother taught all the movie stars' kids how to swim. Paul Newman and Lee Remick, every movie star at the time. Nat Cole. I taught Natalie and Kelly Cole how to swim.
Really?
And used to have Kelly... in the pool with me, and Nat Cole would be walking around the pool smoking cigarettes. He was a chain smoker. And I'd have Kelly sing, "When the blue of the night meets the gold of the day," you know, Bing Crosby's theme song, and Nat would go, ha, ha, ha. But it was slightly humorous. But I taught a lot of kids. I taught all of Paul Newman's kids. In fact, one of his daughters used to bite me on the ankle when I'd be talking to Joanne Woodward.
How old were you when you started working professionally when you started playing with other bands?
I was 12 in Jacksonville, Florida. And I just started playing the trumpet, and I started working with Gene Brandt's band at Washington Hotel there. Everybody was gone in the war. And so I started working, and then I came to California and started college at 16. I started to go to USC, and then I switched over to City College because they had such a good music department. So I went to college there for a couple of years, and then I joined the Air Force, and then I got out of the Air Force, and I worked a lot with Mexican bands. I worked at Million Dollar Theater downtown Los Angeles, all Mexican shows. And then I went in the... I joined Stan Kenton. And went to New York and played at Birdland with Stan Kenton. And Chet Baker was already there in New York, and he was already acting real wild. He played opposite Miles Davis, and this threw him off. Before he went to New York, he would smoke grass sometimes, but then he got all involved in heroin and everything else in New York. And then, he got really messed up then, and he never really was the same after that. Because he was a great kid, and then he got too wild, but he always was a great genius of a trumpet player.
I want to ask you something else about your sound. Do you think that there's a connection between the way you sing and the way you play trumpet?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Just, all the wrong things I do on the trumpet, I do with the voice, too. But I'm trying to eliminate that now and get... I want my pitch to be better and... my preciseness. Now, that's what I'm getting with my lessons. You know, in jazz, we can hit a note and go, kind of come up to it. And in classical music, you have to be precisely on the pitch, singing and playing the trumpet. And this is something that I never really watched when I was... I always had pretty good pitch, but I would, you know, come up to notes or go down to them. And in the classical music, my teacher's always stopping me and say, no, right on the pitch, hit the note on the pitch. I think it just helps, if anything. It just makes you more efficient and competent.
Jack Sheldon, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm so flattered you had me on. It's a thrill. I love your show, and it's a great show, and thank you very much.
That was trumpeter and vocalist Jack Sheldon speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. Jack Sheldon died last month. He was 88 years old. Let's hear one more of his great performances from Schoolhouse Rock.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction, junction, how's that function?
I got three favorite cars that get most of my job done.
Conjunction, junction, what's their function?
I got and, but, and, or, they'll get you pretty far. And, that's an additive, like this and that. But, that's sort of the opposite, not this, but that. And then there's or, O-R, when you have a choice like this or that. Making them run right. Milk and honey, bread and butter, peas and rice.
Hey, that's nice.
Dirty but happy, digging and scratching, losing your shoe and a button or two. He's poor but honest, sad but true. Boo!
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two cars to one when you say something like this. Choice, either now or later, or no choice. Neither now nor ever.
Hey, that's clever.
Eat this or that, grow thin or fat. Never mind, I wouldn't do that, I'm fat enough now.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up phrases and clauses that balance like out of the frying pan and into the fire. He cut loose the sandbags, but the balloon wouldn't go any higher. Let's go up to the mountains or down to the seas. You should always say thank you or at least say please.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses in complex sentences like in the mornings when I'm usually wide awake.
That's Jack Sheldon from Schoolhouse Rock. If you want to hear interviews and performances with the jazz musicians Bob Duro and Dave Frischberg, who wrote many of the songs for Schoolhouse Rock, visit our website, freshairarchive.org, and click on the magnifying glass search icon and type in Schoolhouse Rock. Or visit the Jazz Legends Collection to listen to our interviews with other giants of jazz, such as Sonny Rollins, Art Blakey, Stan Getz, Dave Brubeck, Nancy Wilson, and Max Roach. After a break, our critic at large, John Powers, reviews the new HBO series The Outsider, based on a novel by Stephen King. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The new HBO series The Outsider, based on a suspense novel by Stephen King, stars Ben Mendelsohn and Cynthia Erivo as detectives trying to solve a murder that seems to defy all logic. Our critic at large, John Powers, says this adaptation takes the master of horror's work in an unexpected direction.
If you made a list of the most important figures in pop culture over the last half century, near the top you'd have to put Stephen King. Since publishing his first novel, Carrie, in 1974, the 72-year-old writer has been a literary juggernaut whose books have spawned 26 TV shows and 47 movies. Still going strong, King is best known for exploring and tapping into that most primal of emotions, fear. Fear of madness and menstrual blood, fear of killer clowns and demonic pets, fear of addiction and entrapment. Such fear takes the form of a slow-building dread in The Outsider, the new 10-part HBO series based on King's 2018 novel of the same title. Though this adaptation is probably too well-heeled for its pulpy material, the show has a terrific plot hook. And once I made peace with its moody rhythms, I found myself hooked. I devoured the 6 hours available for preview in 2 nights. The Outsider begins when the body of a murdered and sexually assaulted 11-year-old boy is found in the Georgia woods. The investigation is led by righteously angry police detective Ralph Anderson, who's mourning the recent death of his own teenage son. Ralph is played by grizzled Ben Mendelsohn, who my women friends tell me is a sex symbol, though I've merely thought of him as one of those superb Australian actors that Hollywood now prefers to their grizzled American counterparts. The evidence quickly leads Ralph to arrest Terry Maitland. That's Jason Bateman, a beloved local schoolteacher who coached Ralph's son in Little League. The case against him seems open and shut. Witnesses put Terry at the scene. Video footage confirms it, as do the DNA samples. There's just one problem, a huge one. Other witnesses, backed by video footage, put Terry in a full room in another city at the time of the murder. Ralph begins to have doubts, and here he expresses them to the ambitious local DA, who wants to nail Terry to boost his own career.
If Terry Maitland is innocent...
Which he's not.
If he is, we're not done. This happens again... How badly do you want to win, Kenneth?
I don't know, Ralph. How badly do you want to lose?
Faced with a baffling enigma, Ralph enlists the help of a private eye, Holly Gibney, a spectrumy savant of astonishing mental gifts. She's exceedingly well played by British musician and actress Cynthia Erivo, who recently starred in the Harriet Tubman biopic. As Holly pursues leads to other cities and crimes, things get spookier and spookier. Although The Outsider is no masterwork in a TV era when we expect them, it is a finely tooled series with the trademark HBO luster, sharply elegant scripts by Richard Price and Dennis Lehane, and excellent performances, including Julian Nicholson as Terry's wife, Glory, who's furious at what's happening to her husband, Mare Winningham as Ralph's sensible wife, Jeannie, still shell-shocked by the death of their son, and Derek Cecil as a good-hearted ex-cop who is smitten by Holly, a socially maladroit woman other men just find weird. Bateman directed the first 2 episodes, and he lays down a slow, surprisingly mournful template. Where most thrillers and horror tales don't claim to be more than good, trashy fun, The Outsider takes its story seriously. So seriously, in fact, that some viewers may find it pretentious or exasperating. Me, I thought this approach made an interesting change. Rather than amp things up to make us shriek, the series slowly fuels our anxiety by taking time to make us care about the characters. Despite its lack of visual ambition, the show works similar terrain to the recent run of art horror movies like Suspiria, Midsommar, and The Lighthouse, all of which care less about making the audience scream in terror than about exploring what underlies the terror. Without giving anything away, I can tell you that The Outsider deals with grief and the horrors unleashed by grieving, as well as the fear of contamination by uncontrollable forces, a fear that influences everything from our immigration policy to the way supermarkets put hand sanitizer by their doors. In the process, The Outsider captures the quality that has always given King's work its seductive power. It draws the connection between our inner demons and the ones roaming out in the world.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large. He reviewed the new HBO series, The Outsider, based on a suspense novel by Stephen King. On Monday's show, in the 1890s, Wilmington, North Carolina had a thriving black middle class, a large black electorate, and black representatives in local government. But that ended in 1898 with a bloody campaign of violence and intimidation by white supremacists. On the next Fresh Air, our guest will be journalist David Zucchino. His new book is titled Wilmington's Lie. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.B. Nesper. Thea Challoner directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. And from the Gruber Family Foundation, supporting NPR's efforts to promote deeper thinking, broader perspectives, and trusted fact-based information, always with the goal of creating a more informed public.